Hey everyone, this is Charlie Shrem, and you're listening to Untold Stories. This is a show where we dive deep into the lives and personal histories of some of crypto's most influential leaders and find out how the crypto movement truly came to be. Let's dive in. On the show today, we had one of the most famous people in the tech world, Bram Cohen, the founder and creator of the BitTorrent protocol almost 20 years ago. He brought about the golden age of peer-to-peer file sharing in the early 2000s. Within a year of starting the project in 2003, files shared on the BitTorrent protocol made up more than a third of all traffic on the internet. You would think that a guy like Bram has like solidified his legacy in the world, you know, creating BitTorrent and everything, but he's back, launching the next version of his legacy, and that's the Chia Network. What he claims is the better version of Bitcoin. But before you like get all up in arms, listen to this episode, because Bram is not coming from a point of negativity. He comes from a point of love of Satoshi, of love of Bitcoin. Bitcoin has solidified its place in the future in the world. I have to say, like, talking to him on this episode, there have been multiple times where Bram said, yeah, originally this was my opinion, this was my thought, this was my business, this was my code, but then I realized that it actually doesn't work, and so I improved on it, or I changed it, or I abandoned it. Bram is one of the first people that I've spoken to, and it's interesting how successful he is, that he's willing to admit his mistakes and admit to say, like, I was a little bit like caught off guard here, because usually when you have people that are so brilliant and have done so much in the world to really make a dent on the world as we know it today, those people are very unwilling to like be open-minded. So this conversation was so wonderful. I'm gonna have him as a part two. We had some really cool topics. I didn't even know Hal Finney talked about the topics of Bitcoin 10 years before Bitcoin was even invented at Bram's conference in 2001. What did he talk about? Listen to the ads and we'll talk right after. How do you actually live your life on crypto? How do you do it? I've been doing it since I first got started with Bitcoin back in, what, like 2011. But since 2016, I've been using the BitPay debit card to spend my Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis. And it's been such a great product that I've been using it for over 3 years. BitPay is now sponsoring Untold Stories, and they're going to be giving away free Visa debit cards to all my listeners. All you have to do is visit bitpay.com/Charlie. It's such an easy card to use. You get the card in the mail, you download the BitPay app, you put Bitcoin on the app, and when you want to send Bitcoin from the app into your debit card, it only takes a few seconds and you can spend your Bitcoin anywhere credit cards are offered. It's really so easy. You almost wonder, like, why didn't this come out in 2011 when Bitcoin first launched? Well, it was very difficult to do. In fact, I actually tried to launch my own debit card, but I wasn't able to because the credit card companies were very reluctant to do it. But now BitPay launched their product, and a lot of other companies have launched credit cards and debit cards using Bitcoin over the years. I still will only use the BitPay card. I'm very loyal to the brands I like, and I hope you guys are too. The fees are very low. You can use it to withdraw cash at ATMs. You can use it all around the world with very, very low fees. A lot of companies have tacked on like super high fees, and I don't like that. So check it out, bitpay.com/Charlie. That's bitpay.com/Charlie. You get a free card. You don't have to pay for it. Usually the card costs like 10 bucks or more. There's a commitment, but you don't have to do that here. There's literally no reason to not try it out. I've been using it for over 3 years. Over the years, a lot of companies have tried doing crypto social networking. But the problem is that there are a lot of really good social networking apps already out there, like Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat. How do we build a social network that's perfect for crypto? Well, I want to talk about Peppo. Peppo is an amazing social media app that's built for the crypto community. What's really cool about it is that you can get rewarded for uploading and putting out good content, and you can also reward with crypto people who put up content that you really, really like. It's fast and simple, and it's the first crypto-powered app to be approved by the Apple and Google App Stores. You can find me on Peppo right now at Charlie Shrem, the same handle as my Twitter, and I'm going to be posting interviews, travel videos, and more. So make sure you check out Peppo. It's super cool. Peppo.com. Enjoy it. Untold Stories wouldn't be here without the amazing production company Blockworks Group. few months ago, I approached Blockworks Group and I said, hey guys, I want to do a show, Untold Stories. Can we make it happen? And these guys are the only event and podcast production company that I trust. Really, the show is powered by them, and it wouldn't be here today without the amazing work of the Blockworks Group team. So for access to all the premier digital asset conferences and to check out their other podcasts in their network that they produce, check them out at blockworksgroup.io. That's blockworksgroup.io. I promise you will not be disappointed. I'm very grateful to be sitting here today with the co-founder and CEO of the Chia Network and the co-founder and one of those famous people, especially in the tech circles, of the founder of the creator of the BitTorrent protocol, Bram Cohen. Bram, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me here.
Bram, your story goes back like 20 plus years. And when I had found out that you were entering the crypto space, I was very excited because, you know, I'm a fanboy of you. I grew up with BitTorrent. I grew up not just like using it, but also studying and being a part of the evolution of data and being able to have data be distributed. And, you know, that whole concept of data being distributed and, you know, potentially encrypted on multiple people's computers all over the world, it was a very new and novel concept. And then when you had, you know, originally started talking about it, and then eventually theorizing and developing and creating BitTorrent, finally people started to pay attention and eventually BitTorrent traffic was a third of all the traffic on the internet. That was a huge, huge thing. Ryan Singer, your co-founder, and I know he's not part of the company anymore. He's we kind of grew up in the crypto space together. We were on a panel in 2011 talking about Bitcoin in San Francisco, and we actually lived together in like an old crack motel. So when Ryan called me up and he's like, I'm working with Bram on this, I was like, oh shit, Bram Cohen? And he said, yeah. And I said, I have to meet you. I have to figure this out. I have to understand what you're doing. And then we did meet. And I don't know if you remember, we actually had breakfast together with like 15.
That's Satoshi around
here. Yeah, but I was like a little bit of like nervous. And I didn't want to bother you at breakfast and start like pounding you with questions. So I'm happy that I have this show now. So thank you again for coming on the show. Thank you.
Oh, sure.
Do you see like... Do you ever like look at your life as almost like a saga and a story that had a story arc that went on during those years, and then you know not peaked, but it had its crazy story arc in 2005 when you had to butting heads with the record labels and the movie companies, and you know I'm being very general here, of course. But, you know, and then if you were to look at your life or someone were to look at your life now, they'd say, like, Bram did some crazy things. He has an immense legacy. He's probably living the good life with his wife and kids now, you know, and probably doing some cool stuff. But here you are, like, doing it all over again. Why?
Well, and why not? I mean,
you're a problem solver in your brain, I know. But, like, it's... Yeah, the same question. Like, why? What made you want to do something as immense and as broad and as you know, game changing as launching the Chia Network, which literally is trying to be the next Bitcoin, the better Bitcoin? And I want to preface this to you and to all my listeners. The most hardened maximalist that I've had on the show. FYI, I just want to say this. I will have people on this show that talk about having a better Bitcoin or the next Bitcoin. This is okay. And all of the maximalists I have on the show, Bram, they will admit and tell you that the Bitcoin that we know it today may not be the Bitcoin that we know it in the future. So the ones on Twitter and Instagram or whatever are telling me, yeah, Charlie, all those fucking shit coins. Let me tell you something. It's prudent and pragmatic to talk about these conversations.
Okay. Well, you just said a whole bunch of things there.
I know. I'm sorry.
let me try and get through things here. So there's a question of, like, what's the point in just sitting on a beach the entire rest of your life? I mean, I have nothing against sitting on beaches. Beaches are great. But if you're just sitting there doing nothing, it's like, well, why not just curl up and die if there's no point to the rest of your life anymore in terms of what you do? You know, Garry Kasparov, right? He was the world chess champion. He was a great hero. He could have just retired rich and had an easy life the rest of his life and just sort of either been neutral or talked vaguely positively about whatever dictator is in charge of Russia at the moment. But instead, he decided that he would dedicate his life to promoting democracy in Russia. And it's made his life very difficult, much more difficult than it would have been had he simply decided to finish off after his first act. And I applaud that. I think that's great. Like, he would probably tell you that there's not much difference. You don't make, in some sense, that much difference in the world being, you know, the world chess champion. Someone's going to be the world chess champion. If it wasn't you, it would have been the person who was second. But by really sticking his neck out, he's doing something that no one else of equal prominence has been willing to do in Russia.
That's a great quote. Someone will have to be, you know, the first best in something, right? So like you talk about an Olympic athlete. They did amazing things in our lives, broke glass ceilings or whatever. Especially if they were like, you know, a minority or whatever. But I guess that's a good point, right? I never thought about that. You know, have you done something that someone else will have done or someone else was behind you in second place? Or have you done something that no one else even like thought to do? So when you were originally like coming up with a lot of the concept around BitTorrent, and I actually know that you conceptualized this when you were working at a failed.com company. Can you briefly like kind of tell us that story? And then I want to, you know, draw parallels on, and we talked about this briefly, but like, are you seeing the same community in the early tech world as you're seeing in the crypto world today?
So there were a few years in my life that seemed to go on forever at the time. And looking at it, you know, on a calendar now, it wasn't that long. But there was this period of time between like when I dropped out of college and started working at a startup in New York City and then moved to San Francisco. And so that was in 96. And then I moved to San Francisco in 1997. And that was a whole lot of craziness. And then I worked for a bunch of startups over a few years. And then I worked at one called Mojo Nation, which was a cryptocurrency. It sounds a little silly to call it a cryptocurrency. Because, you know, mining hadn't been invented yet. But if Ripple's a cryptocurrency, Mojo Nation was a cryptocurrency.
Ripple's not a cryptocurrency, but whatever.
Yeah. But Mojo Nation had a token. The model was, we're going to make a token that people are going to use to trade with each other for services online, including the thought was pieces of content and bandwidth and things like that. And the business model of the company was to have a pre-mine and make money off of that.
That was the business model? That's a great business model.
Yeah. It was. Now, this was horribly ahead of its time in many ways, and also it collapsed under its own weight. It was trying to do way too many things. It was supposed to be the all singing, all dancing cypherpunk project, which did everything. And it was just way, way ahead of its time. You know, the internet bandwidth was horrible.
What year was this again?
This would be
like around a range or whatever.
This would be 2000. Okay. That company went down. And then I started working. So that collapsed, although it's really this notable thing. Like people have asked me, like people just, you know, at social functions, not knowing any better, have asked me like, how'd you get involved in cryptocurrencies or when did you start?
What do you answer? Cause I don't know what to say to that myself too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's sort of like two answers and I'm often like, I don't know what to say to that. So people are like, so either like, well, 20 years ago, or
10 years or, before Satoshi wrote the white paper.
Yeah, there's a totally reasonable claim to this. Yeah. And in some sense, Satoshi's white paper was very much a follow-on to this. You know, Hal Finney presented Bitcoin at my conference. It wasn't called Bitcoin. Mining hadn't been invented yet, but it was like, hey, if we assume the security of Intel trusted hardware, we can build this thing.
Wait, Hal Finney presented something at CodeCon?
Yeah.
What did he talk about?
I'm forgetting the name of the project, but it was...
what did he theorize or something? Yeah.
It was Bitcoin. It was basically Bitcoin, but it relied on Intel trusted hardware because mining hadn't been invented yet. And then Satoshi invented mining afterwards and made Bitcoin.
I have to say, I know that a lot of people claim that, you know, who started Bitcoin, Hal, and you have all these other people. Of course, it's, you know, not Craig Wright or whatever, but a lot of people who claim Hal started it point to his early work and the fact that Satoshi worked with him. And then it's a stupid question, but do you think, based on, you know, those presentations pre-Bitcoin, do you think there are, you know, Hal could have been Satoshi, or Hal could have been part of that group?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's pretty easy to avoid giving yourself away when you're dead.
It's a good point. But I guess my only response to that is, after all the work that Satoshi did to like stay anonymous or remain anonymous, and I'm using in the single, you know, it could be plural though, but then you have someone like Hal who was like, either said, I'm like part of the Satoshi group and I don't care anybody, I'm just going to like talk to Satoshi group, who's like people that I know anyways, as if I don't know that. Like, it just doesn't really make sense, I guess. Maybe Hal really wanted to be part of the Satoshi group and knew potential people, but didn't want to give them away. I don't know. All I know is that we lost a brilliant, brilliant individual, and it's a shame.
Yeah, it's very clear that Hal did a lot of the work leading up to Bitcoin, like at least everything but the final inventing of mining that happened there. The thing that gives me nightmares is there was my old roommate and very good friend, Len Sassman, who at one point was the maintainer of Mixmaster. And he, you know, his posting pseudonymously on cypherpunks was his shtick. He did it like all the time. It was like his thing. And he was all like rah-rah cypherpunkly as well. And he was in... he was in a graduate program at the time Satoshi was doing his thing. And Len, unfortunately, he killed himself right around the time Satoshi disappeared.
Oh my God.
So, yeah.
So you don't like this guy, or you think he would have been?
So the thing is, Len and Hal, like, they knew each other. They like worked together at PGP way, way back in the day. Mm. I don't know how widely known this is, but Hal was basically the moving force behind PGP, and like Phil Zimmerman just kind of was the front man.
Isn't it interesting how that happens, though? Thing. Some of the people behind, you know, interestingly enough, but I guess you could say that Bitcoin was more of like a culmination of a lot of the work that involved you, Hal, the gentleman you described, Phil Zimmerman, you know, Adam Back to an extent, Wade. It just a culmination of all these technologies and everything. Satoshi was like the connector that kind of put it all together. But is it fair to us to say that Satoshi's work is the end all be all? Or if, you know, you come along and say, maybe we're not done culminating, right? You see kind of where I'm going with this?
Yeah. So if we back up a little bit here. So after Mojo Nation just kind of imploded, it really just ran into technical issues with trying to do too much stuff all at once. I was very young at the time, but had learned this lesson of the term of art is now minimum viable product. I'd learned, okay, whatever you do, ship something, get a working product out there. And so I licked my wounds a bit, and I took the lessons I'd learned from working on these various startups, and I created BitTorrent just on my own as a much simpler project that just did one thing that was all about bandwidth optimization and had tit for tat for incentivization instead of this whole big complicated token thing. And that obviously went on to be very successful. And so I did that company for a really long time. And that was that was a long and sordid tale where, unfortunately, the highlight was all at the very beginning. but did accomplish some things over the years there. And then more recently, I was, you know, I'd heard stuff about Bitcoin. And, you know, the story around this is super sketchy because there's a long history of randos making projects. They almost always have really serious security problems. And actually, Bitcoin wasn't different that way in that there were like there was the op return originally in Bitcoin where someone could have just stolen all the monies. But there were enough people who were excited about Bitcoin that they came and fixed it. And there was, you know, a core idea there that was a good idea.
That wasn't the only time that Bitcoin had existential threat. There were multiple times, but even a few years later, there was another issue where, like you just said, there were enough people. And so when basically Bitcoin split into two, and it's debatable, was it a soft fork, hard fork? I've had so many people on the show debating it. But regardless, the good, you know, the miners that made money on the correct chain ended up paying back or offered to pay back the miners on the incorrect chain. So it's like stuff that you see like that.
Well, that thankfully was intervened with fast enough that was stopped after just a few hours.
Yeah, I remember.
I remember the day it happened. Greg Maxwell was freaking out. I can opine about what went down there and technical opinions on it. But yeah, the project very much, if there weren't a very active core developer community, the project would have died long ago. But anyway, the main reason people were excited about it was, you know, number go up. Like, hey, look, I'm making money. I bought Bitcoin. I don't know what that means, but I bought Bitcoin and the value of it went up over time. And so that's why people are excited about it. It's like, I don't care about that. That's not what I'm about. I lived through the dot-com boom. This is not interesting to me. But then I believe it was Dan Kaminsky who was like, Graham, there really is something actually interesting in there. You should really go learn about it. So I went and investigated a bit and started learning about it. And at one point, I was, you know, researching it and coming up with ideas. And at one point, I just happenstance heard about the Bitcoin Wizards IRC channel. So I went on that and immediately everyone like jumps in.
One of my favorite channels. I do miss how Bitcoin was so much more on IRC.
Well, you know, it's a common thing with online communities that online communities start out very open. And like I remember the early days of the internet. I got on the internet in fall of 1993, and that was they said that was the fall which never ended because prior to that there was this thing where every single year there would be an influx of noobs on the internet in the fall of every year as people got into college, and then people would learn to behave after a few months. But that was right at the point where the influx stopped being dominated by people who just got internet access.
That's so cool. That's so cool, though. I didn't know that. That's very cool.
Yeah. So, there was a time when, you know, Usenet worked. There was a time when just like open mailing lists worked. And unfortunately, as things get bigger, inevitably, too many people come in and you get people who are abusive and you get spam. I remember, you know, the world's first spam campaign on Usenet. This was a notable and entertaining thing at the time. And then things stop working and then you start having to have policing of it. And it's very, very hard to manage this growth trajectory. You know, back in 1997, you could just start a mailing list. There were actually so few mailing lists that almost any mailing list at all would rapidly get way too much traffic and flame out.
What year was this?
This was 1997.
So it was more like quantity over quality in a way. It wasn't curated.
Just on a purely technical level, there were not the tools to set up a mailing list. You actually had to go do something. You had to install software and do ops on a machine to get a mailing list running.
Like running a node in the early days of Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly. And so so when I came out here, I just decided to leave New York City. I'm like, okay, I'm sick of New York City and I want to move somewhere far away, but still in the continental United States, to a place where I can get work as a programmer and get around without a car. And everybody told me I should move to San Francisco. It's like, okay, cool. We have unanimity. Yeah. I'm going to move to San Francisco.
It's the most consensus you'll ever get in life.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, it's kind of like if somebody who didn't know any better was going around saying, you know, I really want to get work as an actor. Where should I move? Everyone
would talk about it. Oh, hey, speaking of which, not to segue, but March, Bitcoin 2020, I'll be there. I think a lot of people will in San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah. So will I.
Okay.
So, cool. So I was like, okay, great. How do I find a job and a place to live? And so somebody recommended a mailing list to me. Or he recommended, he's like, go to this website. There's a mailing list. So I went and signed up and I got on the website and I read every message posted to it. Right. It was just, you know, local community stuff, parties and happenings and things like that. And it was the usual, you know, mailing list that was rapidly getting too much traffic because there was such a huge influx of people onto the internet and not enough mailing lists for them all. And so I did get a job and a place to – not the place to live, but I did find a job out of this mailing list. And it started getting really big. This was – tell you how long ago this was. I had, like, taken all my stuff and packed it up in my old room in my parents' house and caught a red-eye flight out to San Francisco that had a stopover in Vegas because it was super cheap. And then I was staying in hostels out here. And I was accessing the internet by, there were these VT100s, or well, they were probably like VT300s, but basically these text terminals that you could like put a quarter into and be on the internet for a bit. And I would telnet out because this was back when worrying about man in the middle of the attacks was just like paranoid delusion. And so I would like unencrypted telnet out to a machine that I would read my mail using Pine on. So this is a long time ago. So anyway, I was on this mailing list and this one did it right. You know, it started putting things in the headers to say what type of thing it was. Eventually it made it so you could subscribe to just like subsets of community things. And it kept getting bigger. And eventually I unsubscribed from it because it was just too much traffic and I had other stuff going on. But it got quite popular and eventually spread to other cities. It was run by this guy named Craig.
Not the same Craig.
Yes, that Craig.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, I was on Craigslist when it was a mailing list, like a mailman.
What was the list about? And what was Craig like back then?
Same as he is now. Very, you know, awkward.
Yeah. But in a hostile way? Why is he so hostile then?
I don't know. I've never found him to be hostile. But
I spent like multiple hours on video chat with him. Uh-huh. You know, in 2016, 2017, in a very honest way, the most open mind possible. You know, he could have started on that. You know, video chat said, I am Satoshi. Here's why. Or here I'm not. Meaning that it could have been a very good.
Oh, No. This is Craig Newmark.
I'm talking about Craig Wright.
Oh, yeah. No. The mailing list was Craigslist.
Oh, okay. Craig. No. Craigslist Craig. Okay.
Yeah.
We got to be careful which Craig we're talking about here. I like that Craigslist.
No. Yeah. Yeah. That was Craig Newmark, who's...
Let me ask you a question.
Not a jerk.
that Craig, everyone likes. Let me ask you a question that I thought of earlier, and before you continue, that I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about earlier, there a lot of the theories, the technology, the algorithms, the ideas behind Bitcoin existed already, and it wasn't until Satoshi had brought things together and solved the Byzantine generals problem and create mm-hmm. Created the idea behind proof of work. Well, not just created the idea behind proof of work, but you know, made it into something that can actually be done using mining. And we'll talk about. I want to talk about proof of work versus proof of space that Chia is mm-hmm. working on in a second. But the question, and one of the last questions I'll have with BitTorrent is that: Were there? This is going to be a large question. Was there technology that had existed that you incorporated into BitTorrent? And was there technology that wasn't there that you and your brother and other people were able to kind of like solve and then incorporate that into like a puzzle and then say, okay, now this will work? Similar to like as if Satoshi was sitting in a room and said, okay, all this technology exists. Let me solve this. And then this will make Bitcoin work. Do you kind of see what I'm asking there?
Yeah. So, you know, you have to solve the problems that are in front of you, which are very often nothing at all like the problems you envisioned you would be spending your time on when you work on something. So in the case of BitTorrent, there's very, very little cryptography in BitTorrent. And in the early days of it, I mean, I guess it was one of these things, I was a nobody back then. And I guess it was one of these things people were sort of approaching me like they approached Satoshi. They're like, well, this is some nobody yabo who clearly is some J random hacker who has no idea what they're doing, who might have managed to hack out a chunk of code, but obviously must have messed up their theory. And so I would get a lot of academics lecturing me about error correcting codes and how I should have been using error correcting codes. And this could obviously have been made a lot better with error correcting codes. And it's like, no, I know about error correcting codes. Okay. It's like, yeah. I'm well aware. And here's why they're inapplicable. And I have an actual explanation of this. And the funny thing is years later, I got excited about error correcting codes, because based very loosely, there was an academic paper on error correcting codes, which suggested something really basic. And I actually thought they weren't being basic enough. And I went through and I figured out there's a perfectly reasonable approach to using error correcting codes based off of XOR. That you can create these. You can create these XOR blocks. That you take, in addition to the list of hashes that you have, you increase its size by 50%, and you say, well, here are the XORs of adjacent pairs of blocks in the whole thing. All right, so you've kind of doubled your block size and used this 2-of-3 scheme, this very trivial 2-of-3 scheme on your individual blocks. And this gets you a legitimate benefit. What this does is makes it so that if you have a seeder that's fast and two downloaders that are very slow. So they're not uploading to each other very quickly. And you're going to have a situation where they both join at the same time and they're both going to download half of the data from the seeder, but not much at all to each other. And then the seeder is going to die. Okay. So they've now downloaded a complete file's worth of data,
independently. So one guy got half, the other guy got half, the first guy died. Okay.
Yeah. So in principle, it seems like they should be able to recover if the seeder goes offline right this moment.
In principle.
Now, if you're just using rarest first and downloading pieces, this can't happen. There must be overlaps.
Do the overlaps have to like verify each other to make sure that the data is not corrupted? I've always wondered how you did that.
If they just do this and they're doing rarest first, they can accomplish this. All right. So they each download half the file. All right. Now, let's take a slightly more complicated scenario, okay? Because rarest first does actually work pretty well. Let's say there's three of them who are downloading, right? And the seeder's uploading. And each of these downloaders downloads half the file's worth of data. And then at the exact same moment, the seeder and one of the downloaders, a maliciously picked one of the downloaders, is going to disappear, okay? So this is a more complicated scenario. And but in principle, you should be able to recover from it. You now have two peers, both of whom downloaded a whole file's worth of data. So they should be able to recover. The problem is that if you think about just with two of them, right, you have the first one, or the first downloader, they downloaded some half of the file. It doesn't matter which half. The next one will have downloaded the other half, right? The third one, when they pick what to download, is going to have to do overlaps with the other two. So what's going to have to happen is if the two have made completely disjoint sets, then the third one has to pick which one of the other two they're downloading redundant data with. And then if the other downloader is the one who disappears, there's going to be data of necessity missing. There's going to be stuff that you don't have redundantly with that second peer. So now this is a place where XOR can really help you, because if you have XOR, you can have the first peer download, you know, the low pieces of each pair. The second peer download the high pieces of each pair, and the third peer download the XORs of each pair. And now, if any one of them disappears, they can still recover the file. So I got excited about this. I thought this was pretty neat. And the horrible irony of the whole thing is whenever I've explained this to people, all it's done is succeeded in convincing them that error correction is a bad idea. That this is not worth it. But my actual analysis that actually came up with something is what serves to convince people that it's not a good idea. Which,
how do you actually live your life on crypto? How do you do it? I've been doing it since I first got started with Bitcoin back in, 2011? But since 2016, I've been using the BitPay debit card to spend my Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis. And it's been such a great product that I've been using it for over 3 years. BitPay is now sponsoring Untold Stories, and they're going to be giving away free Visa debit cards to all my listeners. All you have to do is visit bitpay.com/Charlie. It's such an easy card to use. You get the card in the mail, you download the BitPay app, you put Bitcoin on the app, and when you want to send Bitcoin from the app into your debit card, it only takes a few seconds and you can spend your Bitcoin anywhere credit cards are offered. It's really so easy. You almost wonder, like, why didn't this come out in 2011 when Bitcoin first launched? Well, it was very difficult to do. In fact, I actually tried to launch my own debit card, but I wasn't able to, because the credit card companies were very reluctant to do it. But now BitPay launched their product, and a lot of other companies have launched credit cards and debit cards using Bitcoin over the years. I still will only use the BitPay card. I'm very loyal to the brands I like, and I hope you guys are too. The fees are very low. You can use it to withdraw cash at ATMs. You can use it all around the world with very, very low fees. A lot of companies have tacked on like super high fees, and I don't like that. So check it out, bitpay.com/Charlie. That's bitpay.com/Charlie. You get a free card. You don't have to pay for it. Usually the card costs like 10 bucks or more. There's a commitment, but you don't have to do that here. It's a free card. There's literally no reason to not try it out. I've been using it for over 3 years. So check it out, and thanks for listening to Untold Stories. Over the years, I've learned a lot from crypto winters, a lot of the bull and bear markets, and there's a lot of things that I've learned. But one of the most important things that I've learned is that community is one of our strongest assets. It allows us to continue working together and talking to each other during the good times, the bad times, and hopefully not the ugly times. Over the past few months, I've been speaking with the Peppo team. These guys have spent years working with members of the crypto community and learning what we want in social sharing apps. And I'm really excited that Peppo is now one of the sponsors for Untold Stories. Even in the few weeks since they launched Peppo at DevCon, not that long ago, I've seen them make so many improvements, like hashtag search based on feedback from people using the app, and so many different features that combine the best parts of what we already love, that parts of Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, but it combines it in a perfect way with such a nice user experience and good security. It combines them so perfectly that it looks like, and it actually was built for the crypto community. You could download the app by going to peppo.com/stories, and you can find me there at Charlie Shrem, the same as my Twitter handle. So you were like game, you know, wargaming almost like the relationship between the seeder and the downloader to come up with what ifs, like what if this would happen? What if that would happen? And I've always wondered how you're able to do that.
So all the problems in BitTorrent are not these like beautiful academic problems. They're ugly engineering. It's all about reliability and failover. So reliable systems on a technical level, it doesn't necessarily mean that things have low downtime and are robust, although one hopes it does. It means they have failover, that if something goes bad, you move over to something else. So the key idea in BitTorrent was, okay, we have a whole bunch of peers out there. And I know, because I have actual experience doing this, these peers suck. They have slow connections. We don't know how fast their connections are. They're going to disappear at any time. But the one thing they have is upload capacity. And so what we want to do is utilize as much of this upload capacity as possible from these really crappy, untrusted resources. And so how do we go about doing that? And that's where all the difficult problems come in. And they're not these beautiful ethereal mathematical things. They're these kind of like ugly, hacky, empirical failover kind of tricks.
Up until BitTorrent, the way people would understand, I mean, and it wasn't the 1980s. I mean, this was the early 2000s, but up until then, the way we understood downloading files off the internet, and I guess no one realized that you couldn't really have the internet without being able to share data, you know, very rapidly and easily and securely. But also, no one was thinking about this without the interference of, like, you know, dictatorships, or without the interference of, you know, where data can be blacklisted or whatever. But I guess my point is that until this was all theorized, and this way before Bitcoin, the way we understood downloading files on the internet was you're downloading, like you said, from a peer, from one source. And then here you go. And I remember. So, dude, I remember, you know, going on Kazaa or Kazaa. And I remember, dude, I remember how long it took to download a file from IRC. So people were downloading files from IRC. Remember how shitty that was and how long that took to download even anything? Just a 5-minute clip of a funny video would take 2 hours to download. 2 hours, like 2 days through IRC. Was that theory? Did anyone talk about, like, hey, what if we made a system where you could download? It's such a basic, simple understanding. Like one of those things that, like, oh, I can't believe. Why would we do it the other way? Why would we download from one source? It's such a great idea to say, oh, awesome. Let's have, you know, if you could have the ability to have files on the internet or data be able to download in real time from multiple peers or multiple sources in real time, like, it's a great con. It's distributed. It's decentralized. It's wonderful. Did anyone talk about that before?
Well, the difference with BitTorrent, and actually at times I've seen people who wrote competing software at the time write long screeds claiming BitTorrent didn't do anything new. And they're wrong. The thing that BitTorrent did that other things didn't was that you started uploading while you were still downloading. That the files cut into a whole bunch of pieces, and before you'd even gotten the whole thing, you could start uploading the pieces that you already had to your peers. And it does a reasonable job of trying to get the pieces that your peers don't have already. And the one bit of cryptography in it is you download the secure hashes of all the pieces up front so you can validate their integrity as you get them.
Wow, that's a good point.
Yeah. So those were new. And most of the techniques for how to do this well were new as well. But there were times when I was working on it where it's like, can't I do something simpler? This is so complicated. And the thing is, you can't. It doesn't work that way. When you're building a reliable system, it's very either or, right? People have this intuition about how you engineer things, that you engineer at some level and then you work on it, you scale it up by a factor of two, and you scale it up by a factor of two from there, and you keep working your way up. And when you're working on reliable systems, it's not like that. It's like you're working on a thing and it's not working, but you're it has fundamentally sound.
You know, it should foundations. Work.
Yeah, you know, it should work. And because in principle, the techniques you're using should be able to do it. And it's much more complicated and difficult than the straightforward approach, but you keep working at it. You keep working at it. At some point, it hits this tipping point where all of a sudden it's working, and then whomp, it just obliterates the other approaches that you were trying before.
We talked earlier about culmination and like, is that culmination earlier? And before you answer that, I had another question. While you were in, you know, the heat of the moment, while you were in the throes of this and the most fervor, and you were really into it, and you were like, you know, waking up every day saying, I'm building this amazing technology and I'm changing the world. If someone were to come to you, if someone did come to you, maybe they did, and say, hey, you know what, or someone, you know, not come to you, but outside of you, say, Brant, or talk about BitTorrent and say, like, I've invented a better BitTorrent that plays on BitTorrent, but it's better. Do you think, or did you look at that with like, you know, an open mind, or would you have gotten, or did you get emotional and say, no, mine's the best. No one could have done better.
I mean, at some point you just start rolling your eyes and like, whatever. It's kind of like people claiming to be Satoshi, right? Like, yeah, sure. I'm sure this thing
just
that you
kinda
whipped
like
up
over at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that thing that you whipped up is great. Yeah. Whatever.
So, Is the culmination over now? Like, do you think Satoshi's white paper was the end all of this technology, this Bitcoin? Like, will Bitcoin be what we know it as, you know, like 100 years from now, assuming it still exists? Or do you think that the evolution is continuing and that we need to maybe create a whole new chain potentially? I mean, that's kind of what you're doing now. So your answer.
Bitcoin is not the end of the road. It's close. It's very hard to improve on Bitcoin.
I like that you say that. I like that. That's a good thing to say. It's hard to improve on Bitcoin. It's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on a few levels. So with Bitcoin, there's two big aspects of it that matter. Number one, there's the consensus algorithm. And number two, there's the on-chain programming environment. And these are two separate things with their own issues in Bitcoin. But
let's tackle the first one.
So back to that story I was telling before. I got on Bitcoin Wizards. And so everyone joins because like, oh, Bram's here. So backing up even more, sometimes people ask me, you know, how did you get involved in crypto? And I'm like, I don't know how to answer that. So the other answer I will give is, you know, people were kind of waiting for me. they knew I was going to show up.
You laugh, but when I found out you were in the space, I'll be totally honest with you. I said, it's about time.
Yeah,
knew it. I didn't know you or know any. I knew of you. I knew what you did. But I always wondered why you didn't jump in like earlier, but I guess it's the same reason why, you know, even someone like Adam Back didn't jump. I think he came in after you, but it's the same type of situation.
So I was,
that's funny though.
Yeah. So I joined Bitcoin Wizards and everyone joins and I don't know these people. Right. So there were some people like, Greg Maxwell and Andy Toshi are like, oh, we got to talk to Bram. And, there's some people like Taj who no one had heard of at the time, like, oh, great, Bram's in. He's going to ask a whole lot of stupid questions and people are actually going to answer his stupid questions. So I better I'll go in and listen in on this. So Andrew Polstra immediately was sent me a link to the Bitcoin Wizards ASICs FAQ. And that one makes the case that you can't do better than than just being ASIC friendly, that trying to be ASIC resistant is a fool's errand and a bad goal and you shouldn't do it. And I was like, no, that's true. Not true. You can totally do better. And we got into an argument about it. The argument is still going.
This is a still going argument. In fact, I had this debate with someone yesterday who's launching another coin called Ethercoin, a totally different subject. I don't want to get into it.
Yeah.
Where he's literally saying, I want to do like a hybrid between Ethereum and Bitcoin and make it ASIC resistant called Ethercoin. But it's the argument is still going.
Yeah. The Well, Ethereum is just trying brute force to make an ASIC resistant proof of work algorithm, which
that's,
at this point I agree is a bad idea. That's going to fail. All that you wind up doing there is slowing down. You buy a little bit of time before
you
people
incentivize
come in with the ASICs. Yeah, but then you incentivize people to spend a huge amount of resources designing these ASICs. And you've created this giant moat that once someone does make ASICs and has put R&D into making the ASICs, they're going to have better ASICs than everybody else. And you're going to have this huge centralization factor around whoever has the best ASICs. And that's a very bad thing. And what you really want is for your mining hardware to be commodity. And the way you achieve that is by being ASIC friendly, just making it simple and straightforward to do. So if people want a traditional proof of work algorithm, my honest suggestion to everybody is use SHA-3 iterated 100 times as your proof of work algorithm. SHA-3, because it's super, super well designed to be easy and straightforward in hardware, and iterate 100 times to get rid of ASIC boost and related kind of weirdnesses. Just make sure there's nothing funny at the very beginning or very end of the whole thing.
Got it.
And also, if you make it so that you make kind of weird, crappy chips that have high failure rates in the middle, they won't work if it has to go through the whole thing without making a mistake. So that's my very prosaic suggestion, if anyone has that problem. So I was initially arguing in favor of memory hard proof of work. It turns out I was wrong on that point. That totally doesn't work. Andrew had a point here. However, there's a loophole. I continue to maintain that there's a loophole. So the loophole is proofs of space, but you can't do a half measure. You really have to go through proofs of space. And then you can't like just use proofs of space because it winds up having all kinds of grinding attacks. It turns out you need to throw in proofs of time into the whole thing and kind of design the ecosystem in the right way around it. And then at the end of it, it does work. So Andrew has not yet updated the Bitcoin Wizards ASICs fact.
Let me ask you a question.
But I am going to win this argument. He is going to update that webpage eventually.
If you're listening to this show, change that webpage.
Actually, I was just talking to him the other day, and he was saying that he might put in a footnote at this point, saying,
better than nothing,
proof
right?
Proof of space might be a thing, needs more research, blah, blah, blah.
Well, so let me understand it. And if I can understand it, then maybe we could turn some heads here. So I understand how proof of time would work, and I don't think we need to go into that. Proof of time is more of a reference type of situation. But with proof of space, can't that be faked? And I guess you could say, like, what type of, not verification, but what work are you requiring people to do with that you need more space to do that work to prove that they actually have the space that they're saying that they have?
So there's actually a proof of space algorithm that's beautiful and simple and busted.
Oh, great.
I later on gave a presentation at Bitcoin Devs in San Francisco where I was talking about how you can't get away from proof of work. I was taking Andrew's side of the argument. And at the end of the presentation, I was like, if with proof of space, if you take some ideas other people came up with, you take some ideas I came up with, you put them all in a blender together, it might work. So Christoph Piechak, who was the lead on Spacemint, the advisor on Spacemint, which is the sort of academic proof of space project, was sitting right in front of me in the audience by total coincidence. I'd never met him before. And he walked up to me and was like, hey, I think I know what proof of space algorithm you've come up with, and it's busted. I was like, really? So we got into a discussion of it. And I looked it up later, and sure enough, it was busted. So it's busted for a really interesting reason. There's a way of fixing it, which is even more interesting. And the two kind of cancel out in that your intuitions about the original thing are basically right, and you could just pretend it's doing that and not this whole complicated thing. So the simple one that I can explain is you generate a whole bunch of public keys just locally on your machine, and you store these in sorted order on your hard drive. You've stored them to this hard drive. you do a sort on disk, you've got sorted public keys. Now, when a query, when a challenge comes in, the hash of the last block, you go, okay, and then you go and find the closest public key to that challenge. And the rule is whoever has the closest public key in the entire system gets to make the next block and move the whole thing forward. That's the simple algorithm. Now, what this enables is if you have space, you can answer queries with very low latency. And that very low latency is actually really important here and is the reason why you need to throw in the proofs of time. That you can answer queries with much less space, with much higher latency, and you don't want to have that. So you need something enforcing this low latency.
Ah, very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So you throw in... So proof of space are really the hero of the show here. But proof of time is necessary for securing the whole thing.
So proof of time and proof of space together, you think is better, not better, I don't like to use that term, but is more efficient when it comes to energy, but more secure as well? Do you think it's
There's a subtle economic argument here. Which is important, which is there's already a lot of over-provisioned storage capacity in the world. If there weren't, this really wouldn't be any different. This would be a Baroque way of making it wouldn't make sense to talk about ASICs in that context. If there weren't, this would be a very Baroque way of making it so that all the resources that went into mining would be going into generating the hardware for the mining rather than burning power at the time of the mining happened, which actually is also a good thing to do because it makes the system a lot more secure. With Bitcoin, you have this problem that when the price changes, people just stop mining. Whenever the price drops, miners drop out. But
we don't see that with Bitcoin. We didn't see that over the bear markets. We see, in fact, maybe even more miners because Bitcoin's, coin investor loyalty metric is high and people...
Over last summer, it wasn't true earlier, but over last summer, there definitely were mining operations that dropped out. There's also a lot of irrationality in mining. People lose a lot of money.
Of course, but that's mining. Mining is irrational. It's not a profitable venture on day one. You need to have a huge ideology. You have to have, a belief in the ideology behind it to say that this will be profitable down the road. And I feel like, and I hate to say it, but I feel like it's almost by design, right? Like, I feel like it's almost by design.
Greg Bexwell has a story that in 2014, some VCs wanted to talk to him. And he went and spoke to the VCs. They're like, well, we ran the numbers and we figured out we can make mining hardware and it's going to, cost us this much and we'll make this much in profit and we're going to take over 60% of all mining capacity in the world. And Greg's like, that's not really a good idea. It's better if it's decentralized. And they're like, nope, we're going to do it. Okay.
Did they?
And so then he went and spoke to some more VCs and they said, okay, we ran the numbers and we can make some mining hardware. We're going to do this. We're going to make this much money and we're going to be 60% of all mining capacity. And Greg's like, oh, you really shouldn't do that. It's better if things are decentralized, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, nope, we're going to do it. And he's like, okay. So then he spoke to another VC and they said, oh, well, we figured out we could take over 60% of all mining capacity. And of course, at this point, Greg goes, okay, whatever. Because
he's heard it before.
There's something important here,
okay,
which is there's work difficulty resets. You can't have multiple entities earning 60% of the rewards. There's a fixed pile of rewards, and the work difficulty reset in Bitcoin works really well. So what happens is when a whole bunch of people dive in doing this, they just split the rewards amongst each other, and they all lose money.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what happened.
That's one of the most basic tenets of the difficulty reset that's so, so important. And to give you the other side of that story, during those same years in 2013, 2012, my friend Yifu Guo was the one who created the first working ASIC. And I had the second one. Mike Hearn had the first one. Gave it to Jeff Garzik. I had the second one in my office. I was mining like 30 Bitcoin a day. And if you look at the numbers, I was one of the only ASICs on the Bitcoin network. I have to get the data because I just for fun, I want to have it. But I turned off. It was actually too hot. I turned it off. The point is that I asked Ifu, I said, Ifu, if you grew up a block away from me in Brooklyn and you're a brilliant guy, but if you could do this, why could no one else? And he said simply, it's a very simple reason, anyone else can. However, they have to invest millions of dollars into building out the supply chain in China, building out the conveyor belts, building out the ability to create an ASIC, which is basically a freaking paperweight, and if it's not mining for Bitcoin. But no one has the belief and the foresight in the future to believe in Bitcoin at this point to do it. But I do, so I'm going to do it. And that by design, I feel like mining is not meant to be profitable on day one because you don't want to incentivize people to get into mining who just want to make money because they will have no loyalty.
Well, mining is just about the most commodity thing you could possibly get. Kind of by design. Like I was saying, it should actually be more ASIC friendly than it is, but SHA-2 is actually pretty darn good for that. People think that making mining hardware is being, you know, a visionary leader in a high tech field and propelling Bitcoin forward. It's not. It's like I was saying, there's going to be someone who's the best basketball player in the world, right? It doesn't matter who it is. The system is designed so there will be a best basketball player in the world, and people will watch basketball games to see this person perform well. And if you get rid of whoever's number one, then it's just the best person is going to be whoever's currently number two, and the game will be just about as entertaining, possibly more entertaining. People kind of like it in sports if there's one, you know, clear leader among everyone else. And if you get a whole bunch of really good people, they tend to all cluster together. The miners are kind of the janitors in the whole system. They're the support staff. They are not propelling things forward. They're supposed to be running a commodity business at very tight margins. And it's really not something which VCs should be investing in by design.
I have to say I agree with you on this. I have to say I do agree with you on this. I do know some, you know, VC funds I know a lot of, but if you talk to them, you know, the leaders of these funds, and a lot of them put in their own money into their own funds, are like in love with crypto as more of like, you know, and they believe in the future of this industry. So that's why they do it. And I like how we're talking here and you're saying like, you know, there are drawbacks, there are attack vectors, and we're discussing the differences between them, and we're also discussing like how they can be fixed. I have one question. You invented Bram's Fortress, which is a better version of the Rubik's Cube. How do I beat it?
So Bram's Fortress, I don't think there's been more than one copy of it made ever. So Bram's Fortress, the way that's set up, it's basically 8 Rubik's cubes that are at the corners of a 2x2x2 that are geared together. So all the ones on the top, when you rotate their tops, they all move together, and same on the other sides. If you ever work on solving a restricted Rubik's cube with such that you can only move 3 of the faces, the top, front, and left faces?
Yes.
That's not too hard to figure out how to do if you're familiar with how to solve a Rubik's cube generally.
I don't. I need to figure it out.
Yeah.
One of these
days. There are many common sequences on a Rubik's cube that will work on that setup. On Bram's Fortress, you could solve one of the corner things using that. That would then tend to the moves on that would tend to scramble up the adjacent cubes on it. However, those ones would have like you could use like if it was like front, top, and left were the slices that you were using. If you solve the top, front, left cube on it, that would tend to scramble up, you know, the top, front, right, and two others on the left. But you could use as a that's the term they use. The other sequence that you could use to mix sequences with that one with is just turning the right on its own. Because that would have very low overlap with those things where it, the top front right cube would be the only one that would have any interactions there. So you could mix that together. It kind of winds up being this multi-layered thing of mixing together sequences. When you're solving permutation puzzles in general, the basic approach is you have a sequence. They call them algorithms, which makes me cringe, but you have a sequence of moves. And then if you want to mix together two sequences of moves, it's called, they're called co-something or others. It's basically the name. But you have two sequences of moves that have a small amount of overlap between them. So if they're A and B, you do A and then B and then A inverse and B inverse. And if the amount of inverse just means backwards. And if the amount of overlap between them is very small, then you're not going to have moved very many pieces as you do this. And then you can layer this together where that itself, that combination of stuff will itself be a sequence. And you can use that to interact with some other set of things, sometimes just a trivial moving of one slice. And that will move even fewer things. So you stack this up together like two or three times, and you have something which only moves like two or three pieces together, and you use those to solve the entire cube. That's the basic approach that one takes for solving these things.
Thank you for telling me how to do that, because I've you know, been, when I was doing my research, I was like, I need to figure this out. You mentioned something earlier.
I invent mechanical puzzles.
Yeah, you do recreational mathematics, which up until I was in prison, I didn't know was like who the hell would sit and do recreational mathematics. But when I find myself with hundreds of extra hours, that's what I ended up doing.
Yes. I actually invent mechanical puzzles which are in mass production.
I saw some on what's that 3D printing site that there's a few of them. I saw some Shapeways. Of your work there. Shapeways. Yeah.
So Bram's Fortress is an example of one that's only been prototyped in 3D printed form. But there are some that are actually in mass production. So there's like one called Fidgets, Fidgitz, which you can get for $10. That's a really interesting mechanical puzzle.
Oh, cool.
That kind of hit the sweet spot of being both something that is really interesting if you're really into such things and is approachable enough that the general public like enjoys.
I know I left, there's a museum in Vienna called like the Museum of Optical Illusions. You should check it out if you're ever there. They have other ones too. I think this was the original. What's cool about the gift shop is the largest place that I found that you can buy and see and play with mechanical puzzles and different, different types of wooden ones and metal ones, whatever. And so I remember seeing one. I was so excited. I was like, oh, I've seen this before. I want to try to solve it. I took it off the shelf. I opened it up in my excitement. I started solving it. And I'm sitting there for 30 minutes and I'm playing. And I solved it. My wife is like, Charlie, you didn't pay for that. You just grabbed it off the shelf. I was like, yeah, but I already solved it already. I don't want it anymore. But so I ended up paying for it. But in my excitement, I was like, jumping into it. But we're running out of time. I had a question I wanted to ask you. And answer this based on your understanding of Chia, Bitcoin, and BitTorrent. What do you think of being able of there's kind of two schools of thought that we're seeing in crypto now. You're seeing schools of thought that are saying like, leave the main chain, leave the code base to let it do its thing as small as possible, as basic as possible, and everything else should be done on layers, layers, layers. And that's kind of like the Bitcoin school now. And you have the other school that's like, let's do as many things on the main chain as possible. You know, there are a lot of there are arguments for both ways. You built scalable technology, and you're building scalable technology now. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a little complicated. For the most part, I side with the Bitcoin core devs. That a lot of what people talk about when people discuss scaling, this is not a complicated discussion. Really, when you say on-chain scaling, all this really means is, hey, let's make the blockchain bigger. And this has the very obvious trade-off that it becomes very expensive to run a full node if you just make the blockchain bigger, and this has some pretty severe centralization trade-offs. Ethereum only really supports like double the transaction rate of Bitcoin does, and it's already like falling over and there are hardly any full nodes running. Now, a lot of that is just because of bad engineering in terms of how Ethereum works. But even if it didn't have bad engineering, it would still be, you know, doing the same trade-offs. It would just be able to go like one order of magnitude higher before it started becoming super dodgy.
Yeah.
So one can talk about, you know, where is the scaling limit set to, but it's not going up by like two orders of magnitude. It's going up by like a factor of 10, if that. And so it's not even really a big problem at the moment. So there's this thing called the fee market, right? So with Bitcoin, the attitude that the Bitcoin core devs are taking is, look, if if blocks are full, then what should happen is fees should go up, and people who want their transactions to go through quicker should pay more. And people who are willing to wait a little bit or wait a unknown amount of time will pay less. And then people will change their behaviors either by being more efficient about their transactions or putting through transactions at another time or something like that, and be able to just pay less for their transaction fees. And you'll get market equilibrium on that. And the Bitcoin core devs are like, look, until we see a situation where we have like persistent high transaction fees that aren't going down to zero for several hours every night, and where there aren't known straightforward ways that people could improve things, until we get to that situation, we're not even going to consider doing any like crazy hard fork here. We're just going to sit on our hands and let the transaction fee market work. And it does.
Yeah.
And it's really, really weird how people freak out about there being any transaction fees at all. This is literally like people who claim to be uber libertarians freaking out about how we don't have like from each full node according to their ability to each person doing transactions according to their need. It's like, it's completely
I know.
Communist
and approach I think that narrative was created in order to like create the whole, I think that the narrative of big blocks was created very early on by some very smart people in order to wrestle control of a segment of the crypto industry.
There was definitely a power struggle going on, and there was
we needed that to happen, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, the power struggle resulted in an outcome, right? Like, so you kind of had like Gavin and Jeff and Mike Hearn on one side, and then you know, basically everybody else on the other side. And what wound up happening was the people who were kind of the, you know, the in-your-face spokespeople for the project weren't actually the people doing the most important work on the whole thing. And they decided they should be in charge. And other people were like, no, you're not in charge.
That's awesome.
And Gavin was just weird about wanting to do hard fork scaling to just ridiculous amounts and wanted to do things that were very much not in the spirit of the whole thing. And he got to be the front face of Bitcoin development because nobody else wanted to be, because what kind of crazy person would stick their neck out that way?
Yeah. It was kind of all interesting how it all played out. I missed, like, there was like a 6 month or a year gap that I had missed a lot of this drama. I'm so happy that I missed that drama, though, that I didn't get caught up in it. But I'm also really grateful for the conversation we had today. I know it's early. Really, really great convo. And it's not finished. I'd love to have you on for a part two. I will.
Sure.
Thank you for sitting here with me this morning and for talking all things, you know, Chia Network, early BitTorrent days, some cool, really cool stories. Bram, I'll see you I'll see you at the end of March in Bitcoin 2020. I'm excited to be there and I'm doing a talk with Sirius, actually the founder of Bitcoin.org and the Bitcoin Talk forums. So like, he's some crazy stories of like, you know, arguing with Satoshi and things like that. I can't wait to talk about. So Bram, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. New episodes of Untold Stories are released every Tuesday and Thursday at 7 a.m. EST on untoldstories.com, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Untold Stories is produced by Jason Janowitz, Michael E. Polito, Reed Hannaford, and Riley Silbert of Blockworks Group. Our account executives are Gina DeFelice and Julie Muroff. Our content is written by Kathy Zolo, Ronnie Tishner, and Scott Offer. Special thanks to Wayne Dallaire from Jump Dog Audio Productions. And of course, I'm your host, Charlie Schrem. You can follow me on Twitter at Charlie Schrem to continue the conversation. Send me some messages, feedback, or anything you want to say. And remember, please give some love to my sponsors, and I'll see you next week. Remember, strength in numbers, and information is power.